Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 4th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today's session number is 3 and is titled The Here and Now Revolution. Let's listen in.
By people who believe that individuals could create social change by the power of ideas, by example, and to a lesser extent by organization, but they really believed in the power of ideas and the power of example. And I suspect that that idea was also in Philadelphia 220 years ago, when a group of men gave us a reason for celebrating the 4th of July. It wasn't a holiday in 1776, but it is now. For a long time, it was celebrated the way that holidays are supposed to be. The word holiday comes from the word holy day. As a holy day, as a day of thanksgiving and reflection. But now it's celebrated, as somebody just said, as all other American holidays are, as a day of rest, relaxation, consumption, sales, and display. We use it as free time more than as a time for freedom. Today, because I'm a historian, I'd like to spend a little time on reflection. I'd like to think about the here and now revolution that faces us in the way that historians do, which is telling you about there and then. Historians are always crafty that way. We never talk about here and now. We always talk about there and then. But in fact, we're always talking about here and now. And you just sort of have to read between the lines to see it. And what I'd like to do to start with is just read some parts of the Declaration of Independence. Because if we're normal Americans, it's probably been a while since we've heard it. Politicians don't tend to seem to read it very much. The press doesn't read it on the 4th of July. They tend to, if you've watched the news tonight, which we won't hear, of course, but if you watch the news tonight, there will be pictures of the fireworks displays because they're good visuals. But the Declaration of Independence is not a good visual. So, but anyway, we're here at Holden, and this is a tape ministry that has no visual anyway. So I thought I'd at least read a little bit of the Declaration of Independence. I'll start at the beginning. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. And then there's a long list of facts that are in here. And then it concludes, we therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. and that's the way it ends. So that's what we're celebrating today. All those syllables, it wouldn't play well in sound bites, I don't think. Having read the text, then, let's think for a little bit about the context. What was the Declaration of Independence for 220 years ago? It wasn't to start the Revolutionary War. The colonies had already been in a state of armed insurrection for more than a year. Lexington and Concord were on April 19th of 1775. So from April of 1775 to July of 1776, there had been a war going on. The Battle of Bunker Hill preceded this. The United States had invaded Canada in this time. There had been battles in most of the major cities by July of 1776. So this is not to get a war going. It also wasn't primarily to influence public opinion. Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which had been published in January of 1776, had already done that. I mean, it was just one of the first pamphlets that just really went after King George, and it was printed by the hundreds of thousands in a country that only had 3 million people total. So it is sort of the hot bestseller of 1776 and really influences opinion quite a lot. And it was a much more inflammatory and interesting kind of thing to read than this document was. So this one wasn't intended to do that. In fact, the real reason for the Declaration of Independence and the real audience for it was the French. Because the French wouldn't ally with a group of colonies that might go back to Britain. They wanted them to declare their independence before they would make any alliance. And the colonists didn't think that they could win without the French support. And as it turned out, they were right. If you remember the Battle of Yorktown, the deciding factor is that the French fleet comes in time to bottle up the British fleet in 1781. So now the other question I want to think about today is, why did Thomas Jefferson and his friends in Philadelphia do this thing to declare independence? What caused this break with England? How could they have been so stupid as to challenge the dominant colonial power in the world? I mean, this would be like, it would be like Nicaragua declaring war against us, or something like that. Great Britain was the established power in the world. When the Minutemen went out on Lexington Green in April of 1775, they were shooting at the very best soldiers in the world. They must have been crazy. They must have been nuts. They must have had something that was really moving them in one way or another. In general, I'd say that the question to that, why did they do it, is that it's very complex, and I don't know all the answers fully. I'm not at all an 18th century historian. I tend to do more 20th century stuff. But in general, things were not that bad in the colonies. If you look at sort of rates of taxation, for example, you know, you hear the phrase, no taxation without representation. Well, in England, people were taxed without representation also, and the taxes were a lot higher than in the colonies. And so the colonists had made an issue out of something that they were worried about, but didn't seem to worry anybody else who was living in the system of virtual representation, which is what it was called when you're represented by somebody you don't actually vote for. It just really wasn't that bad. But one of the things that was going on is that there were social changes going on in the United States or in the colonies in the 18th century that tended to make people nervous and anxious. And those social changes contributed to some extent to the receptiveness that people had to these ideas of liberty when they came around in the 1760s and the 1770s. And in a way, when they're talking about revolution in the 1770s, they're talking about revolution in a way that we don't think of it generally. We think of the revolution as a break, as a discontinuity from the old order. But we have to remember that the main phrase that they used in trying to fight for this revolution was that they were fighting for the rights of Englishmen. And what they were looking for was revolution in the sort of root sense of the word, which was a revolving back around. They were looking for going back to something. And there's a book by Robert Gross called The Minutemen in Their World, which in fact does answer that question that I just asked. How could they have been so silly as to go out there and start shooting at British soldiers? And he looks at Concord, Massachusetts over the course of the 18th century and says, what's going on there? And why is it that these people were so desperate that they would go out and start shooting at British soldiers? And among the things, I can't remember everything that went on in this book, but among the things were the population was increasing really well. in Concord, Massachusetts. The United States, or the colonies, turned out to be a very healthy place to live. England had a very low life expectancy because people were close together and infectious diseases would get you if you were close together. But patterns of settlement in the colonies were tended to be farther apart, so that in the 17th century in New England, the life expectancy of men and women was about, if they lived to year one, the life expectancy was about the same as it is right now in the United States. It gets worse when people start clustering together and then the infectious diseases kind of take them off. But anyway, so you're getting lots and lots more people in Concord, Massachusetts. And the patterns of inheritance there were that they split up all the land, had partible inheritance, and so they split it up. And what that meant is if a man had 10 children, and they had lots of children in those days, and seven of them were boys, it meant that the land that he used to support himself was now divided into seven parcels. And the parcels got smaller and smaller, and people began to lose their land or not be able to make enough money to keep the land. And, interestingly enough, they didn't want to go anywhere else. These were, the colonists tended to be a very settled people. We think of them as frontiersmen, you know, out there pioneering and all that sort of thing. They thought that was stupid, you know. There were Indians out there. It was rough out there. Communities was really what they were about. They were about communities and consensus. And they were very, 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 they didn't really want to go to the frontier. The only thing that eventually moves them to the frontier is simply sheer necessity that they have to go. They get pushed out there. And then in the 19th century, people begin to kind of like the idea because there's an individualism to it. But when you live in communities, you don't want to move out of the communities. And this is kind of a communitarian ethic that people have in the 17th and 18th century. So that's part of what's going on there. Another thing that's going on in the 18th century is that there begin to be religious and political splits. In the 17th century, they come to places like Concord. They form a covenant. The covenant establishes a kind of consensus among them, and there's one church. In the 1740s, the Great Awakening tends to split the churches of New England so that you get New Light and Old Light churches. And this makes people who believe in consensus, who believe that everybody ought to believe one thing, very nervous. They don't like that at all. And they're always looking for ways to sort of get people back together again. And ultimately, what Gross contends is the thing that will get them back together again is an outside enemy. So Great Britain serves perfectly as a way of uniting people who are divided in lots of different ways on the local level during the 18th century. And there's one other book that I want to mention as sort of a background to how the American Revolution works and what was on people's minds. And that's a book by Edmund Morgan called American Slavery, American Freedom. And his thesis in this book is that without slavery, there would have been no revolution and no American freedoms. And it's a wonderful paradox. But basically what he says is this, is that slavery gave the colonists a living example of what it meant to be not free. When they charged King George with absolute tyranny, or another phrase that they like to use a lot in the revolutionary pamphlets and things, was that King George was planning to enslave us. This is what they had in mind. They were looking at what they had done to their own slaves. So the word freedom had a context that we don't fully understand in a world where slaves aren't around. And the other thing that was important in the way in which slavery was absolutely essential for the American Revolution is that slaves made it possible for planters like Thomas Jefferson to think and write. Jefferson took his slave Jupiter to Philadelphia with him when he went to write the Declaration of Independence. Jupiter served essentially as his valet. But he left behind hundreds of slaves at Monticello, and they were the people who made the wealth that gave him the leisure to be able to read as widely as he did, to know the Locke that he did, to know the political philosophy that he did. So beneath the sort of achievement of Thomas Jefferson are all of these slaves who make possible an American Revolution. If he'd been a kind of yeoman farmer, he'd have been too busy to be writing a Declaration of Independence. And in a way, what the slaves do is to free up the planters in order to have a revolution. A very interesting kind of of situation. Okay, well, so you have these social changes going on at the local level throughout the colonies, things that are making people anxious and uneasy. And then you have ideas that sort of get thrown out there, and many of the ideas work very neatly with the social context. Now, they end up in a philosophy or ideology that I would call a republican ideology, and the term republican is real important, and it's real important for you to know that it doesn't have a capital R on it. It's a small R republican thing, and the Republican Party today is almost 180 degrees from the small R republicanism of the 18th century. But this republican ideology, when we use the term republican, usually when we're talking about the 18th century, what we talk about is republican means electing people to represent you so that we have a representative democracy. That's a republic. And in fact, the United States is a republic. It's not a democracy at all, although we like to use the term democracy more than we like to use the term republic. We're a democratic republic, technically. But republicanism was a much richer word than that in the 18th century, and it meant to the people of that time a lot more than representative government. It was a way of seeing the world and a way of acting in it. And it comes literally from the Latin that many of them knew at that time. Republic comes from the Latin res publica, which means the public things. And it meant basically that you were supposed to act in all of your life, including your private life, with an eye or with some attention or mindfulness to the public good. And a term that they used a lot in the 18th century was virtue. You needed to have virtuous citizens in order to have a democracy. You needed to have people who would govern themselves. So we think of the Declaration of Independence as a thing that allows a new nation to govern itself. They're thinking of the revolution as something that will do that, but as part of that, you have to have people who will govern themselves. In order to have free institutions, you have to have people who are responsible on their own. Some of the people who were in the staff meeting the other night when Martin was talking, he was really giving a kind of Republican speech when he was doing that, saying, the deal at Holden is that everybody looks out for themselves. You don't need to have locks on the doors here because you assume that people are virtuous, and you try to structure the institutions around here to reinforce the virtue that people have, so that you try to make the institutions create people who can create then what I would call a moral ecology that allows for freedom. So the idea was that this is pretty much a lost idea in American politics. It tends to go out. Well, American politics is real interesting at this time. It tends to be an elitist kind of politics where the idea of voting was you were going to elect the best men to be the president or the vice president or your representatives or something like that. And one of the most interesting elections to me is the election of 1800, in which the two main candidates are Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And there are, at that time, two major intellectual societies in the United States, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which I think was in Philadelphia, and I think Jefferson was the president of that, and the other one was the American Philosophical Society, and I think Adams was the president of that. So in a way, what you have is the two leading intellectuals of the United States running for president in 1800. Now, this could never happen now, as you might imagine. I went to college in 1967. I'm an Irish Catholic, and I was very much influenced by John Kennedy. For Catholics, it was sort of like, wow, we've come right into the mainstream if a Catholic can be president. So when I went to college in 1967, I put on my application form. They said, you know, what's your major going to be? I put political science, and they said, what are you going to do with that? I said, I'm going to be president of the United States. I actually put that on there. I was taking political science because I thought you had to know something to be president, which turns out not to be true. That there's a real change, and the change really comes in the Jacksonian era, where essentially Jackson comes in and says, what we want is a government by the common man, and we can't have common men be the governors. And basically, the idea is that any fool can be president. And from then on, that works out pretty well. You know? So a lot of times, any fool can be president, and it still works fairly well. You can also see a kind of difference between the 18th century and now when you think about republicanism and restraint and the ways in which a politics of that time would encourage people to restrain themselves. In fact, one of the things that they did in the revolution, England was also symbolic for them of luxury and of materialism, because all of the luxury imports came from England. And so in the early 1770s, they instituted non-importation acts. And the idea was to maintain their virtue and their purity by cutting off the supply of the luxuries that they were getting. So there was a collective exercise in self-restraint that went on in the 1770s as well. Now, the only time that I can think of that this happened in contemporary American history is in 1979. 1979, if you remember, we're in the middle of the energy crisis, and a whole lot of other things are going in 1979. But Jimmy Carter comes before the nation and talks about the energy crisis, and basically he says, look, we got an energy crisis, and here's the deal. You're the problem. You're driving too damn much. The reason we have an energy crisis is people are consuming too much energy. So stop consuming so much energy. I mean, he didn't say it exactly that way, but he said a malaise, a moral malaise.
No, he didn't use that word, though. He claimed he never used malaise.
Well, I think he did, actually. Yeah. And people responded to that by saying, hey, don't bug us. You know, it's the government's job to solve the energy crisis. Don't make us do anything. And basically, that was the response. And Edward Kennedy really took after him in exactly that way, saying, you know, it is the government's responsibility to do this kind of thing. But this is really very different than the 18th century, where the assumption would be that people would need to govern themselves in order to help solve this problem. They wouldn't say that government has nothing to do with an oil crisis, but they would say that people need to govern themselves and exercise restraint. And this is real similar, this idea of self-restraint and sort of personal politics is real similar to the personalism that I've been looking at in the 1960s. Essentially, this is what a lot of the 1960s activists are about, especially in the first two-thirds of the 1960s. By 1968, they get kind of irritated that nothing is happening with this, and they start looking for quick results, and they start to use a different kind of rhetoric than that. But that's the original rhetoric of it, is this kind of personalist rhetoric. And all of this fits within a framework that Robert Bella establishes in his book, Habits of the Heart, where he talks about four different strands of individualism in American culture. A biblical individualism that comes from the Puritan era, in which people are individuals, but they understand that they're individuals within a community. And probably the best symbol of that would be the covenant, where people covenant with each other to act in certain ways. A really lovely book to read if you're interested in reading anything about the Puritans is a book by Kenneth Lockridge called A New England Town. And in the first few pages of that, he actually gives you the Dedham Town Covenant, which is very short, three or four paragraphs. But what they pledge to each other is mutual love, that they will act with each other in terms of mutual love forever. And this is really what they had covenanted politically. This was the political covenant, not the church covenant. This was what they had covenanted politically to do with each other. So there's an individualism in there, but it's bound to a community. And the second kind of individualism, Bella says, is Republican individualism. And that's what I've been talking about now. Again, it's now that there's an individualism that's established, and that all men are created equal is a kind of individualism. There's an individualism involved in the Enlightenment thinking of people like Jefferson, but it's not a radical individualism that says, I'm me and nobody else has any. I have no responsibilities for anybody else. You're still considered within a network of now more political than religious, although the religious stuff is still at the background of their minds. Most of them assume that you have to have religion in order to have the virtue that you need to have this kind of self-government that you have. But both of these, the biblical and the republican views, place people within community. They're kind of communitarian individualism and a kind of tension built in there. What happens in the 19th century is you get a third kind of individualism, what Bella calls utilitarian individualism. And that's the individualism of laissez-faire economics that says basically everybody can do what they want and everything will work out well. It's what Adam Smith called the invisible hand. If all of us are equally greedy, our greed will turn out to be good for everybody else because we'll be working real hard in whatever we do. And there are ways in which this is true. So, for example, you get in a classroom. If everybody wants an A in that classroom, and they're all working really hard to get an A, often the class conversations are pretty interesting because they're all doing the reading really well. There can be some common good that comes from individual selfishness. We can also work that if you don't give grades at all, that you have great conversations, and the conversations tend to be ones that are not so designed to please the teacher as to find out really what people think and to improve their skills, which doesn't happen so much when we have grades. But anyway, then the fourth kind of individualism that Bella talks about is what he calls expressive individualism, which tends to be the individualism of, I am myself, and I have an inner self, and I have a need to express that inner self, and that's really what I'm here on Earth to do, and basically nobody else is connected with that. And so you move through a kind of sequence of individualisms where the individual becomes really less and less attached to other people in any formal way. Although Bella says, and one of the reasons that he writes the book, is that because we are a country that's established by Puritans and by people, Republicans like Thomas Jefferson, we have those languages as a second language. But most of the time what we speak is what he calls a first language of utilitarian individualism or expressive individualism. We don't have the language, or we don't very often use the language that we have to talk in ways that would bind us into communities. Okay, now the Declaration worked. It affected its purpose. Within a year or two, the United States had contracted an alliance with France, which occupied the British on the continent, and which neutralized the advantage of the British Navy. And within 10 years, the Americans had won their independence. Within 11 years, they had a constitution. A couple years after that, they have it instituted. George Washington becomes president. Looks like a success story. So in many ways, it is. It's a wonderful success story. For some people, though, it wasn't so good. And it had sort of various kinds of things. For slaves, it was not particularly a good revolution. It didn't change their condition at all, although it did get a conversation started about slavery. And the All Men Are Created Equal tended to be a language that was be used over and over and over again in abolitionism in the 19th century. For Native Americans, it was a disaster, because the king had, in the proclamation of 1763, said, here's the western line of settlement, white people can't go beyond that, and the rest of the continent is reserved for Native Americans. The colonists hated that proclamation. It was, and 1763 happens to be just about the time that they get really irritated with the king. They hated that proclamation because it meant they couldn't have all the land out there, and so the revolution is a disaster for Native Americans. And even during the war of the Revolution, the American troops began to fight against the Indians and to plan to really keep fighting against the Indians. Many of the major generals of the post-war period are people who got their experience in the Revolutionary War and then went west to fight Indians in places like Kentucky and Ohio, Indiana. Places that most of the time now when we think about Indian wars, we think of Custer and Montana and South Dakota and things like that, but there were Indian wars all across the continent. And some of them, Anthony Wayne, I think, once said that the idea of the Indian wars was simply to exterminate them. And so in some ways, this was at some levels government policy. So it was a disaster for them. In many ways, because it was a disaster for the Native Americans, it was a disaster for the environment, because you had these English people here who saw the environment mainly as a commodity moving out into an area where people had seen the environment in a different sort of way, in an animistic sort of way, where the land or nature was alive in some ways, which restricted which restricted the way that they could deal with nature. They couldn't destroy it in quite the ways that the English could. Now, it wasn't immediately in a disaster. There were only 3 million English people on the continent at the time of the Revolution, and so, I mean, they just couldn't wreak as much havoc as they might have wanted to, but it was a disaster for them. For women, it was sort of ambiguous. It was pretty clear that all men are created equal, with the men capitalized, didn't mean women, and they were pretty explicit about that, although there were some states that allowed women to vote. For the most part, the Revolution didn't formally do anything for women. What it did, though, is to sort of give them a language and a context in which they might exercise their own freedom. And in Robert Gross's book, The Minutemen and Their World, he tells a wonderful story of a young couple at the time, during the Revolutionary period, where the Revolution sort of unsettles the relationship with Great Britain, but it sort of says everything else is up for grabs, too. You know, if we can break off with Great Britain, we can really rethink lots of things. And one of the things that the women wanted to rethink was that their fathers got to tell them who to marry. That was the practice in New England at that time. Fathers decided who their daughters would marry. And so the women sort of decided we're going to have a revolution of their own. And the way that they do it during the period of the American Revolution is they get pregnant. They have sex before marriage and they get pregnant. And one-third of all marriages at time of marriage, one-third of all wives in New England during the Revolutionary period were pregnant already. It's one of the highest periods, times of illegitimacy in the United States. It goes down again in the 19th century and then comes back up again in the 20th century in the 20s. But Gross tells the story of a couple that wanted to get married, and the father said, "No, you can't marry this guy because he's not as prestigious and wealthy as the guy I want you to marry." And so the woman goes out and gets pregnant, and finally the father says, "Well, you know, since it's this guy's baby, you can go ahead and marry him, but I'm not very happy about this." And they name the baby Lovina, L-O-V-I-N-A. And this is the period where romantic love comes in. It hadn't been assumed that you had to have any romantic love at all for spouses until this time, but romantic love comes really out of the kind of jarring of the revolutionary experience. There are lots of other things having to do with the history of romantic love. It's not, I don't want to contend that the Declaration of Independence leads directly to romantic love. But there is a context in which things are unsettled enough that things like romantic love can come in. So at the time, it has a lot of different impacts on a lot of different kinds of people. Afterwards, the Declaration has been used as a lever against the government that it eventually constituted. And the Declaration of Independence is one of the sort of great kind of pattern models that people use when they're pissed off and they want to get some rights. So the Seneca Falls Declaration of 1848, having to do with women, is modeled on the Declaration of Independence. Frederick Douglass in 1853 was asked to give a 4th of July speech. And he did a wonderful job of using the Declaration of Independence. Does everybody know who Frederick Douglass is?
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass, he was born a slave, had escaped from slavery, and was an abolitionist orator by the 1850s. And he gave a talk in Rochester, New York on the 5th of July, which was their sort of 4th of July celebration. It must have been a Monday. Actually, I don't know why it was on the 5th of July. But he begins by saying essentially, "Why am I called on to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring upon our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence? I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, but not by me." And he goes on and on and on, just sort of takes after this audience for the essentially the hypocrisy of it. And it's used in that way as well throughout the 19th century. The Black Panther Party, when they started in 1966, their first presentation was a reformulation of the Declaration of Independence. The state of Vietnam in the late 40s, when they declared their independence from France, did so with a model of the American Declaration of Independence, and in fact with an American military officer and American military planes flying overhead as Ho Chi Minh declared independence from France in the late 40s. In the mid-60s, a group called Ecology Action in Berkeley, California, did a declaration that was a declaration of interdependence, now expressing the interdependence of people and nature. It's a terrific tradition that the Declaration has given us, and it gives us hope for what I would call a red, white, and blue revolution because of its ideas and assumptions. And I want to just suggest some of the things that it seems to me the Declaration allows us to think about or invites us to think about in terms of a here and now revolution. Some of the principles that are there that seem to me to be still relevant to us now. And these are in no particular order at all. So four, it allows us to think about the mutuality and community of politics from the ending of it. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. One, the responsibility of people for their government and not necessarily vice versa. And these just sort of two ways of looking at self-government as a kind of restraint and as a political government. I think it also allows us to think about a right of revolution and, in fact, as he says in there, an obligation of revolution. When things are not going right, people have a duty to do that. And it's a kind of turning over or turning around. And I'm told this is, in a way, the turning around is also the meaning of the word metanoiete, repent. Isn't that also a kind of turning around? So this revolution also fits with a kind of classical religious sense of repentance, of moving around. It asks us to think about the equality of people and what that means. I don't think Jefferson understood the phrase, all men are created equal, the way that we understand it now. But he said it in such a way that it's grown in 220 years to encompass more and more, and I think it will still. I think the Declaration also alerts us to the importance of nature's laws and of nature's God, to ask how our lives fit with God's plans, and how we are part and parcel of cosmological patterns. Again, most of the time, most of our lives, we tend to be focused in on things that are real narrow and real local, but the Declaration invites us to think, you know, what's the way in which this fits into larger kinds of cosmological patterns? I think the Declaration also asks us to think about the possibilities and the importance of a culture of reason and explanation. When we talk about a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. This is to say what we think ought to happen in politics is reasoned discourse. And not the kind of stuff that we tend to do on talk radio these days. We don't tend to have a lot of reasoned discourse in American culture now. And the Declaration says we have a tradition of that. It's a rich tradition, and it's a tradition that we can go back to, we can revolve to, we can revolt to if we want to. There's also in the Declaration a notion of truth, and I think a truth with a kind of a capital T, at least a sort of three-quarters capital T, grounded in creation, nature's God, nature's laws, a kind of natural theology, kind of think through, if nature is constituted in this way, what is the implication for us? I think the Declaration, at least for me, gives me an example of a person who's interesting and exemplary, and that's Jefferson himself. Jefferson is, I think, an American genius. He was 33 when he wrote the Declaration. He was a politician. He was a political theorist. He was a scientist. He was an agriculturalist. He was a natural historian. He was an architect, and he was a musician. And he may have been a couple other things, too. I can't remember. That was the list that I could think of. I went to Monticello a couple years ago. I was just astounded at the architecture there and sort of the ways in which it embodies a vision of the good life, of a reasoned life, at the same time that, you know, beneath there are the slave quarters, are the ways in which the slaves were going to be doing all this stuff for him. So it also gives you a way of looking at a life of oppression and exploitation. But in many ways, Jefferson seems to me to be the kind of person that would be great in American politics now if he could figure out how to do sound bites out of this stuff. Or if American politics could change so that we would permit more than sound bites. The average sound bite now in American elections is between 4 and 8 seconds. That's the longest that you normally hear on the nightly news when a political candidate speaks. And then the other thing that I think that we get out of the Declaration is an example of how when people act, sometimes things happen. It suggests to us that if we have a revolution in mind, we might want to try it because it might work. There's no guarantees in here. There were a lot of things that went on at that time that didn't work. But here was one that was really against the odds. If you'd been betting in 1776 on this revolution, you'd have bet against it if you really wanted to recover your money. It was not a good bet. And yet it gives us, I think, an example of the kind of thing that we could look for. And then I just want just to end with an anecdote that I think is interesting. The Declaration was on the 4th of July in 1776. Both Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died exactly 50 years later on the 4th of July in 1826. And John Adams' last words were, "Thomas Jefferson still survives," which actually turned out to be not true. He had died a little bit earlier in the day. And then James Madison died 5 years later on the 4th of July. So they seem to have some affection for that date, or either that or just chance works in wonderful and interesting ways. So there are some things for us to think about here on the 4th of July. Any responses or questions or comments?
Why don't you think that America is very good at having rational discourse these days?
Well, television makes it hard because television wants things quick. And we're moving, this is something we talked about a little bit yesterday when we were talking about time. We tend to be moving in a culture that moves faster and faster. And so we tend to sort of, we talked a little bit about, I think afterwards, about Sesame Street. The longest cut you normally see on TV now is 8 seconds. On MTV, it can be a whole lot less than that. And Sesame Street tends to have real fast cuts. So we get accustomed to things happening very fast. And then things that go slow tend to seem dull to us. And teachers work against that all the time. A class is going to be a whole 55 minutes. My God, that's a long time, students think. And in contemporary American culture, they're right. What's interesting in terms of the 4th of July, too, is that most of the time on the 4th of July, none of us do anything that has to do with reflection and any kind of political awareness at all. We just have picnics and go to fireworks. I had a student once who was from Austin, Minnesota, and her father had been the congressman from that area. And in 1910, he had delivered an address to the Austin City picnic, 4th of July picnic. The address was 3 hours long. And it was on the tariff, for God's sake. It was on the tariff, because it was a big issue in 1910. But this was the kind of thing that people expected for a long time. In the Lincoln-Douglas debates, for example, in 1858, each of the two candidates was given 3 hours to lay out their position, and each of them took it. And then they had rejoinders after that. But they expected that people would have an attention span and be able to pay attention for that long and to sort of think.
And they could,
that's true. Now, not everybody could. I mean, I don't want to say this is the good old days and we've lost everything since then. Not everybody could at that time.
But time is only one element of a rational debate. It seems to me that there's rational debate that can be considerably shorter than 3 hours.
Right.
It seems to me that there's something else going on, and I'm not sure why. I mean, I know some of what it is. It's this kind of sloganism that we just content ourselves with calling names at the opposition and trying to wrap ourselves around some small slogan that's a bumper sticker instead of rational discourse. But, I mean, why not a half an hour of rational debate instead of what we get, which is nothing?
I think it's because people are conditioned and trained not to want to pay attention that long and to think that that's dull. I mean, why don't people watch McNeil Lehrer instead of watching the nightly news? I have my students watch the nightly news, two students at a time with a stopwatch, and write down everything that occurs during the nightly news. There are usually 22 stories, about 20 to 22 stories on the nightly news. They average less than 30 seconds. The in-depth story for the night is usually no more than 180 seconds. It's not very good. Most of the time in the news, the longest thing that goes on in the news is the commercials, and they last 8 minutes, 8 to 10 minutes. And that's really what the news is for anyway, is to get you to watch the commercials. So we've sort of conditioned ourselves and trained ourselves, and actually when we watch the news now, we feel like we're informed. I'm up on things. I know what's going on. In fact, mostly you don't. You think you do, but the studies show that most people forget what's in the news within 30 minutes of the time that it's on. But I think there's a kind of conditioning to that. And then there's that, people have different levels of motivation that they act on. And psychologists and focus group people find that you can get people to respond to sloganeering really well. There's a wonderful series by Bill Moyers called The Public Mind, in which he shows them doing, they watch Ronald Reagan tapes. They have a focus group there, and the focus group is told that when they hear something that they like, they're supposed to press these buttons real fast. And then Michael Deaver is in a situation where he can watch the president giving a speech at the same time that he can see the kind of on the screen a bar graph that shows how people are pressing their buttons. So he can know in a speech exactly what words turn people on. And then they just tell Reagan, use those words more. Family, neighborhood, community, those were all big words that master rhetorician, but part of it is simply packaged for him. And Deaver in that program says, we sold him like a bar of soap. And advertising then has a lot to do with the way that our political discourse gets narrowed down. And again, advertising is mostly not rational either. It used to be. If you sort of look at the turn of the century, advertising was largely text. And it meant that you had to read it, and text invites you to think about something. Now advertising is mostly images, and it invites us to feel about something.
I think in connection with your question, partly it has to do with attention span, impatience, so on. I think partly it has to do with the cynicism. We get our propositions in the voter book and so on. You know, I've got some work I have to finish, and I have this other thing and so on. First thing I do is I take a look and I see who's for it and who's against it, and I think I know a whole lot before I start, you know, however far I get, reading into the this and yeah, but da-da-da-da-da. And so I think, to reiterate, I think partly we have grown to sort of distrust our own judgment about what's being presented, or to think that, well, this is all, you know, really good at the idea level, but what's it really about, and, you know, can I really see what's going on here, or am I being tricked?
Right. I mean, in another way of thinking about it is that we have what I would call learned helplessness. We have learned over time that our vote or our participation doesn't make a difference. And a lot of us, therefore, don't participate because we think that's true. I tend to think that's false. It seems to me that it makes a difference where you participate. What I've found at St. Olaf is that the place to participate is on committees where nobody wants to be. But if you sit on a committee, my God, you're a very powerful person, because the words and the language and the ideas that come before the faculty as a whole are the ones that you've crafted. And that's you sort of get them to begin with that frame of mind. And so it seems to me that there are lots of ways in which participation is important. For me, one of the things that, and this has to do with my 60s research also, one of the things that has happened is that government has gotten so big and seems so distant from us, and we have lost the kind of intervening participation in governments close to us. And I'm actually with Newt Gingrich on this. He talks about devolution, which is returning many of the functions of government to lower levels, where people would have a sense that their voice meant more. I am not for him returning everything back down. I mean, the reason we have big government now is that local governments did a very lousy job on a lot of different things. The issue of race is probably the best example. The reason that we have federal civil rights laws now is because the state governments did such a lousy job of it in the 1960s. And I wouldn't give federal rights, and I wouldn't give civil rights enforcement back to the states because I don't trust them. But some things I think could be handled very much at state and local levels. And the 60s people that I'm most interested in are people who were essentially what I would call communitarian anarchists. They wanted people to live in very small groups. And they wanted government not to have much to do with them at all. They wanted people to be self-governing in small groups. And for them, an ideal community might be Holden Village. This might be about the size that they were thinking of. Late in the 1960s, some of them moved out to communes where they tried to do things exactly like this. And that was their model for government. If you want to see a kind of finished, how could this look kind of thing, fictional, Marge Piercy's novel, Women on the Edge of Time, is really a wonderful novel presenting it's called Women on the Edge of Time. Do people know this novel? let me describe it to you a little bit. It's set in 1976, and there's a Puerto Rican woman living in New York in sort of abject poverty who finds that she's able to be transported into a future world of, I think, 20 or 2188. And it's a world that's essentially an ecofeminist utopia. And so it's a very small scale, very ecological, appropriate technology kind of utopia. And it gives a really good vision of the way in which we might think about the future, a future that would be, I think, more satisfying to people than the mega technical world that we now live in. And what happens in the course of this novel is she's able to move back and forth in time. So she goes to this future society where she thinks they're just all crazy because they don't act in the way that people in New York in 1976 act. And so she's asking him all kinds of questions about why do you do this and why do you do that and why do you do that? And try to figure out what's going on there. And then she keeps coming back to New York where she, in the process of the novel, she gets stuck in a mental hospital because these visions that she's having make people hear things that she's crazy. And so she's in this mental hospital. And the purpose of the story and of the title, Woman on the Edge of Time, is to say that all of us are on the edge of time. We're right at the intersection of the past, the present, and the future. And the way we act now determines what future will come. As it turns out, there are two futures out there. One of them is this ecofeminist future, and the other is in a really mega-technical one. Much more so than what we have now. And so Connie, the main character, has to decide by her own actions which future she wants. And again, this has to do with what I was talking about yesterday, with this idea of can we project a future, can we imagine a future? Most of us don't think about a future that might come. And usually when we talk about the future, what we're talking about is adjusting to the future that will come. At one time, St. Olaf was about to rewrite our mission statement, and we had in one of the drafts of it that we were going to help students adjust to the 21st century. And that just infuriated me, because it looks to me like the way things are going, that the 21st century is something I don't want them adjusted to, that it would violate their humanity to be adjusted to the 21st century the way it looks to me it's coming. So I did manage to get that out of it. That's not in the mission of the college anymore. But for the most part, we assume that the future is made by people who aren't us. And essentially, in this country, it's made by large corporations. And they're the ones who market it to us by selling us versions of progress in the forms of particular products.
Chuck? Are you familiar with Daniel Kemmes' book, Community and the Politics of Place, by any chance?
No, I don't know that.
I think you'd be really interested in it, because it kind of connects up with what you were saying about Jefferson's experiment and the issues you're talking about in terms of contemporary American, particularly devolution. He's a former mayor of Missoula, Montana, and has served time in state government there, and it came out about 4 or 5 years ago. Very readable little book, which the first half of which is his take that on the idea of Jeffersonian democracy being dependent on the idea of a frontier, idea of ever expanding possibilities in a land base that could allow wealth to be distributed as far as possible. And the fate of the Jeffersonian idea of democracy lodged in small communities coming into crisis with the closing of the frontier. And the second half of the book is his own call for a kind of a re-inhabitory politics and economics that are more local in scale. And it's really, I think, one of the most thoughtful attempts to do some of the kinds of things that you're raising, but quite intentionally in the tradition of the fathers, as it were.
Oh, great.
It's a good little book, and I like the way you're raising these questions in continuity with some of the original revolutionary insights. Because I think it's a little bit like the Bible and the fundamentalist use of the Bible, and that causes a lot of other folks to back away from the Bible. And my feeling is we can't concede right. Those texts. I think it's a little bit similar with some of the foundational texts of America, that we're conceding too much of it to the chauvinists and don't realize that there are some texts there that are really much more enfranchising and inclusive, or at least potentially so.
Right. I agree with that very much. And the term red, white, and blue revolution is one that I first saw in an article in 1971 when And the early part of the 60s was working towards what I would call a red, white, and blue revolution, and it was working within a structure that was also a structure of biblical individualism. And the best example of that was Martin Luther King. He was a person who could use the biblical tradition and the Republican tradition to really leverage the kinds of changes that he wanted. He wanted a revolution. I mean, he really wanted some substantial changes in this country, particularly by the late 1960s. And he used those languages terrifically effectively. And the reason that he's a national hero now is the fact that he maintained those traditions. What happens in the mid-60s is that you get in black nationalism in the civil rights movement and in a kind of radical Marxist movement in the white student movement, an abandonment of that language of both Republican and biblical individualism. And it's at that time, I think, that people just turn off and say, we're not listening anymore. And so while the demonstrations get larger at the end of the 1960s, it seems to me the audience gets smaller. And it's always the case that while people were, for example, opposed to the war at the end of the 1960s, they were always opposed to the demonstrators more. Even when you could get majorities opposed to the war by the end of the 1960s, you never got majorities who would agree with the demonstrators because they didn't like the language that they were using. And that seems to me that language is a really important language for us to use.
It's ironic because I think it was really the demonstrations that got you against the war. So really brought people
right.
up to start thinking. So it's really ironic.
There's an extraordinary irony there because it is demonstrations that make people think twice about something. This is exactly what Martin Luther King is trying to do in all the demonstrations that he does.